You know how the labs are. Blood work is easy, DNA not so much. She rolled her eyes. I left Tracy to do the grunt work. He should be able to hold things together for a while. No, Harry, Ida is a county commissioner, and we only have... What you have is all circumstantial. I know that, I said, but if I'm right, he does have Phoebe Marsh, or at least he knows where she is. He's using her to pressure Marsh. He wants his money. How do you know all this? She asked. The phone records, I said. James has been talking to Ida for almost 2 months. So has Watts. And Ida has talked to whoever has that burner more than 40 times. These guys are badasses, Kate. What would a guy like Ida be doing with the likes of them? No good, that's for sure. James is freelance muscle, a killer. Watts, too, probably. It's one hell of a stretch, Harry. Just because he's been talking to some rough characters doesn't mean... Rough characters? I interrupted her. I just told you James is a frickin' killer. We know that because he killed Stitch, probably to stop him from talking to me. I saw him do it, and he knew I would come after him for it. I also think he killed Penelope Ross for the same reason, to stop her from talking to me. Then either he or Watts murdered Benny Brown and tried to frame me for it in a weak attempt to put me away, to stop me. I think Ida hired the two of them to kidnap Phoebe and use her to pressure Marsh into revealing where he stashed the money, almost $100 million. I paused, looked at her for a minute, then said, Look, I can't do this on my own. I don't have the authority. You do. She just stared at me, said nothing. Come on, Kate, I thought. What the hell are you thinking about? I tried one more thing. And then there's this, I said, handing her a sheet of paper. I asked Tim to find out who owns the Rose Cafe, now Lucky's Diner. Check it out. She read for a moment, then looked up at me and said, I don't believe it. But I could tell from the look on her face that she did. It's true, I said, and the place is mortgaged up to the rafters. Ida is in so deep he's drowning. I'm betting that Phoebe Marsh is being held at the cafe. Now, can you get a warrant to go search the place? Ask Henry Strange. He has a soft spot for you. She gave me a look. And what about the other Henry, Finkel? He'll lose his onions if I go chasing after a county commissioner. It's not my case, Harry. It's assigned to Eric Cable. I was exasperated. It was the same old all over again. Office politics. I didn't think Kate played that game, but it seems she did. You know what, Kate? I said, this is exactly why I got out. All the freaking red tape. Delay after delay, and in the meantime, there's a kid's life at stake. You do whatever the hell you want. I'm going to see Ida. Then I'm going to take the Rose freaking cafe apart, and James and Watts along with it if they get in the way, and maybe even if they don't. I promised Stitch's dead body I'd get James, and by God, I will. Okay, okay, she said, holding up her hands. I'll call Judge Strange. And she did. And 15 minutes later, we were on our way to the federal building to pick up the warrant. Chapter 22 We made a quick stop by Judge Henry Strange's office to pick up the warrant. Then we headed for the county courthouse. I ran up the courthouse steps, up the stairs to the third floor, and barged into Ida's outer office. Kate identified herself to the receptionist and told her to leave and close the door behind her. Reluctantly, the woman stood, looked at Ida's closed door, then did as she was asked. I nodded my thanks to Kate, then flung open the door to the commissioner's office and strode inside. He was sitting behind his desk, tapping on a computer keyboard. To say he was startled by my sudden appearance in his office would be something of an understatement. He stood up, hands out in front of him as if to ward off the grim reaper, which I suppose I was. "Harry," he stammered. The color had drained from his face. "It was just a joke, I swear. I'll call Henry Finkel and tell him, right now, okay?" He picked up his desk phone and leaned forward to dial. "Sit the hell down, ducky. This isn't about your stupid report, though I should bust your head for it. It's about Phoebe Marsh. Where the hell is she?" He dropped down into his chair as if he'd been shot. "Easy, Harry," Kate said. "Easy my ass. If I don't get what I need, I'm going to take this son of a bitch apart. Now tell me," I said to Ida, "where is she?"
I don't know what you're talking about," he said, regaining some of his composure. "Who is Phoebe Marsh?"
I stared at him, slowly nodding my head, thinking, trying to figure out if I should talk to him or just take his head right off his shoulders. I opted for the first option. I sat down in front of the desk. Kate also sat. I gathered my thoughts, then said calmly, "There's no use denying it, ducky. I have you dead to rights."
"You have nothing," he interrupted me. "You don't have any right to talk to me about anything. You're not even a cop. Now, get the hell out of my office before I call a real cop."
"That would be me," Kate said, cutting him off. "Sergeant Catherine Gazzara, this is my ID, and this," she waved the document in the air, "is a search warrant for this office and your other business." She laid the warrant on the desk in front of him. He stared at it like it was a snake preparing to strike.
"What other business?" he stammered.
"The Rose Cafe," I said. "Lately, a Lucky's Diner, only it ain't so lucky anymore. Now, can we talk, or do I have to get rough with you?"
"I want my lawyer," he said belligerently.
"Tough," I said. "I'm no longer a cop, remember? I don't have to play by the rules anymore, so you either talk to me or I'll hurt you," I said sweetly. He stared at me, said nothing. "I'll take that as a yes," I said, looking at Kate. She was slowly shaking her head at me. I grinned at her. I was feeling pretty good. For the first time in 10 years, I was in charge and didn't have to play by the rules. Good for me. Really tough for Ducky Ida. "Now, Ducky," I said quietly, leaning forward, trying to look earnest, "I know you have two ugly, two nasty-ass sons of bitches working for you. One, Joseph James, also known as JoJo or JJ, and two, a Neanderthal named Amos Watts. I know that they're working for you because I have your phone records and theirs. You want to comment?"
"I've no idea what you're talking about. I don't know any JoJo whatever his name, nor anybody called Watts."
"Ah, Ducky, that won't fly. By the way, you should know I'm recording this," I said, holding up my iPhone for him to see. It's a bit late to tell him now, I thought. Never mind, my bad. "It won't fly because I have a record of all the calls you made to them and them to you, and there are a lot of them, some of them 20 minutes and longer, so you definitely do know them." He didn't answer, but he was beginning to look very uncomfortable. "I also know you had Watts abduct Phoebe Marsh. I know because I was there when he did it."
"You're out of your mind, Stark. Why would I do that?"
"Because you're broke, Ducky. Because Frank Marsh scammed you for every last penny you had. $3.4 million, to be precise. And you thought you could use Phoebe to pressure him into giving it back. But you were wrong, weren't you? Marsh wouldn't play, would he?" He didn't answer, but I had a feeling he was weakening. It was time to hit him in the gut. "Ducky," I said gently, "you're in so deep you're about to drown. You're not only up for kidnapping the girl,
but we can also lay three murders at your feet. A young black kid, Stitch Tree, a witness, Penelope Ross, that was a bit of a stretch, but I was on a roll, and one slimy piece of work by the name of Benny Brown. His eyes bulged. He slowly stood up, pointing at me, his hand trembling.
No, I know nothing about any murders. The girl? Yes, okay, I hired them to take her. You're right, I wanted my money back, but that's all. I had nothing to do with any killings, I swear it.
And you know what? I believed him. Better yet, I now had his confession to Phoebe's abduction, recorded.
Mr. Ida,
Kate said, rising to her feet and reaching for her cuffs. Just a minute, Kate, I said. Let me finish. She nodded and sat down again. Ida looked at me, helpless, a duck out of water, if you'll pardon the pun.
I don't have a, he said. I never did. I don't know who does. One of James's acquaintances, I think. I talked to him on the phone, but I never met him, and I don't know his name.
I believe that, too. He was talking about the unknown Burnaphone.
Where are James and Watts? I asked. There's an apartment above the diner. I let them use it. It's where they're living.
I looked at Kate and nodded. She nodded back, rose to her feet again, grabbed her cuffs, and said, Lawton, Ida, I'm arresting you for the kidnapping of Phoebe Marsh. And she continued reading him his rights, then escorted him downstairs to a waiting police cruiser. We stood for a moment on the courthouse steps and watched them take him away. Then Kate turned to me, smiled, and said,
Good one, Harry. You just solved your first case.
I did, didn't I? How about that?
But you're not done? Not yet.
Nope, not yet. Let's go find Tweedledum and Tweedledee.
Chapter 23
We climbed back into Kate's unmarked cruiser, and together we headed for East 3rd and Lucky's Diner.
You think I should call for backup? She asked.
No, not until we at least know they're there. We wouldn't want to look like a couple of fools, now would we?
Ha, she said. Finkel would love that.
Listen to me, Harry. I know you better than you know yourself.
I know what you're thinking. You can't do it.
Do what? I asked, smiling.
Kill James.
I hear you, Kate, I said, smiling inwardly. That reminds me. I reached inside my jacket for my trusty M&P 9, checked the load, and returned it to its home. Kate sighed and shook her head. We arrived at the front entrance of Lucky's at precisely 3:48 that afternoon. I know because I happened to glance at the clock on her dash to find the place deserted. Except for two very large gentlemen, and I use that word loosely, seated together at the bar drinking coffee.
Hi, guys, I said loudly. How are they hanging?
Oh, shit, I heard Kate whisper. They both looked round over their shoulders. Watts leaped to his feet and over the counter and out through the kitchen. Kate ran around the end of the counter and went after him. James sat still for a moment, staring at me. Then he smiled, stood, turned toward me, feet spread slightly. Then he shrugged, twisted his head first one way, then the other, his hands hanging loosely at his sides, bent slightly at the elbows. His coat was swept back to reveal what could only have been a .45 and a holster at his right hip.
Oh, shit. What does he think this is, OK Corral?
Don't do it, Jojo, I said. I'm faster than you.
Jeez, did I really say that?
He grinned at me. I watched his eyes, and there it was. His right eye twitched, and his right hand moved, and so did mine. It swept up under my jacket, sweeping the gun from its holster and bringing it to bear in one silky swift move. His gun had barely cleared leather when my bullet tore into his right shoulder, spinning him around, the heavy weapon fallen from his hand. He staggered backward, staring at me, his eyes wide, looked down at his right hand and the blood dripping from it to the floor, and then he passed out. So he really can't stand the sight of his own blood. "Watts is gone," Kate said. "He ran out through the kitchen and out into the alley. He had a car. He was in and gone before I could stop him. How about you?" she asked, looking down at the unconscious JoJo James.
"I told you not to kill him, Harry."
"He's not dead," I said. "He passed out again. He'll be okay. I better call for an ambulance, though." She nodded, made the call, and we waited until the EMTs had loaded JoJo up. "Now what?" Kate asked as we walked back to her unmarked cruiser. "We've got to find the kid before they decide she's no longer useful. I was hoping we could persuade one of them to tell us where she is, but..." I was interrupted by the ringtone of my iPhone. I checked the screen. Unknown number. I was just about to decline the call when something stopped me. Reluctantly, I took the call. I hadn't known him long, but I recognized his voice instantly. "Oh, hey, Tim, it's you. What do you have for me?" I listened. "Okay," I said then. "You're kidding. Okay. Okay, got it. And thanks, Tim. You've done good, son. I'll talk to you later." I disconnected, looked at Kate, and said, "Let's go."
Chapter 24. He was sitting on the steps with two of his henchmen. When he saw our car stop in front of the house, he jumped to his feet, ran down the steps, and away up the street. I went after him, gun in hand. Kate followed. He didn't get far. "Hey, Shady, you stupid son of a bitch," I yelled. "Stop, or I'll drop you." He must have believed me because he slowed. The run became a jog, then a fast walk, and then he stopped and slowly turned around to face me, walking backwards, smiling.
"Hello, Harry," Shady Tree said. "I guess you figured it out, huh?"
I held the gun steady in both hands, my head cocked to one side. He shrugged, raised both hands to shoulder level. I lowered my weapon, took a step forward, and as I did, his right hand went for the gun on his hip. "You've got to be kidding me." The thought flashed through my head as I brought my own weapon to bear. Not twice in one day. It happened in slow motion. At least that's what it seemed like. His gun came up and I pulled the trigger. The 9mm copper-coated slug hit the meaty part of his right forearm just below the elbow. His arm snapped backward and the gun flew out of his hand and across the street. He looked at me wide-eyed, unbelieving, shocked, looked down at his arm, then dropped to his knees, grabbed the wound, and looked at me pleading. Then it hit him. His head went back. His eyes squeezed tightly shut as the nerves registered the wound and the pain coursed through him. I holstered my weapon and ran to him.
"You stupid son of a bitch," I said in his ear as I dragged his jacket off and then tore off his shirt sleeve. "I could have killed you."
He was lucky. I could tell the bullet had missed the bone. What it might have done to tendons, muscles, and nerves, I had no idea. "If it had been anybody else but me," I said, "you'd be dead right now." And if I was still a cop, I thought, I'd be disciplined for not taking the kill shot. "Where is she, Shady?" I asked as I used the shirt sleeve to tie off the wound.
"Where's who?" he ground out through gritted teeth.
"You know who." He howled as I gently squeezed the wound. "Where's Phoebe Marsh?" He looked up at me. I don't know if it was pain or hate I saw in his eyes.
"Screw you, Stark."
"No, screw you, you piece of garbage." I squeezed the wound and Shady cried out as the pain intensified.
"Stop it, Harry," Kate said.
"Not until he tells me where she is," I said, looking him right in the eye. It was at that point Shady Tree became a believer.
"She's in the basement," he whispered, his eyes shut tight. Under the floor, north corner, there's a section. It looks like concrete, only it's made of something called vermiculite. It weighs nothing. Comes up easy. Now, will you get me to a hospital?
She'd better be good and healthy, Shady, I said. If not... I didn't bother to finish.
He knew. I could see it in his eyes.
Kate, I said, I'll go look. Keep an eye on him. Call an ambulance if you like. I ran back to the house. The gangbangers were gone. I guess they'd seen what had happened to their boss and decided to get going fast. I ran up the steps into the house, found the basement door next to the kitchen, opened it, and ran down the steps into the basement. It was dark down there, even with the light on. I walked slowly through the garbage to the north corner and looked around the floor. At first, I didn't see anything and was about to go screw Shady's arm some more when I spotted the false concrete slab. It was about 3 feet square, dirty, stained, almost identical to the rest of the concrete floor. If I hadn't been looking for it, I wouldn't have found it. I knelt down, ran my fingers over the smooth surface and edges, trying to find a way to get it up. Nothing. I reached into my pants pocket, took out my tactical pocket knife, flipped it open, and inserted the tip of the blade into the crack that separated the slab from the rest of the floor. Then, gently, I began to lever the slab, hoping to hell I wouldn't snap the blade. But Shady was right. It took very little effort to raise the edge of the slab enough to get my fingers under it. I swear that slab didn't weigh 5 pounds. I lifted it out and set it to one side, revealing a large square opening with steps leading down into the darkness. I turned on my iPhone and used the flashlight to tentatively make my way down the first few steps, feeling my way as I went. 5 steps down on the side of the joist, I found a light switch. I flipped it on and descended the rest of the way into hell. At least that's what it must have felt like to Phoebe. The room was small, no more than 8 feet by 8. Phoebe was in a small cage set against the far wall, and when I say small, I mean tiny. She couldn't stand upright. She was on her butt, her knees pulled up to her chest, and she was filthy. And it also looked like she'd lost weight.
"What the hell took you so long?" she asked wearily.
"And hello to you, too," I said, wondering how the hell I was going to get her out of the cage.
"There's a key," she said, "hanging on the top step to the right."
"Are you okay?" I asked as I pulled the cage door open.
They didn't,
because if they did, Shady is going to pay for it like he's never known.
"Yes, I'm okay, and no, they didn't. They didn't touch me." "What took you so long?" she asked again. "You got my note, right? You talked to Penny, right? You must have, because you're here."
"Penny? You mean Penelope from the Rose Cafe?"
"Yes, she's my friend."
"Oh, shit." "Let's get you out of here," I said, changing the subject and helping her out of the cage and to her feet. She was so stiff she could barely stand. I guided her up the steps into the basement proper, and then up into the main house where we found Kate coming in through the front door.
"Oh, my God," she said. "You found her. That's fantastic. Are you okay?"
Phoebe smiled at her as she limped into the kitchen and sat down at the table.
"Yes, I'm fine. Where is he? That SOB with the dreads. I want to remove his... I want to bust his balls."
"He's outside," Kate said, "with 2 uniforms watching him, waiting for the paramedics. Harry shot him."
"He's dying, right?" she asked gleefully.
"Not hardly," Kate said. "He should be, but Harry only winged him. We need to get you to a hospital, get you checked out."
"Not until I've talked to Penny. Where is she? Can we go see her?"
I looked at Kate, then back at Phoebe. I didn't know what to say.
"Harry," Kate said quietly, "why don't you go and finish up with Shady?"
I nodded, got up, and left them alone together.
Chapter 25
Shady was sitting on the sidewalk, nursing his arm.
"Piss off, Stark," he said, looking up at me. "I don't want no more to do with you."
"I want to talk to you about Stitch," I said, crouching down beside him.
"I don't want to talk about that."
I shook my head, bewildered.
"He was your son, Shady." "I had nothing to do with it. Stitch, he liked her, the girl. Talked to her, but sometimes told her not to worry. He was warned not to talk to nobody. Jojo was watching him at the laundry. Then you, of all people, turns up and Stitch gets in your car. He was warned. He got nobody to blame but himself."
"But you, Shady, what about you? You must feel something."
"It'd be tough out there. Kids, they die all the time. It don't mean a whole lot of nothing," he said, but I could tell that it did.
Even Lester Shady Tree had a heart in there somewhere. Joseph Jojo James survived his wound and was charged with the murder of Benny Brown. CSI found trace evidence on Benny's body and DNA all belonging to Jojo. He was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. Amos Watts was arrested by Border Patrol agents in El Paso and was extradited back to Chattanooga, where he got lucky. He cut a deal with the DA and friend of mine, Larry Spruce. He spilled his guts about Ducky Ida's crimes and got off with just 5 to 10 years in state prison. No one was charged with the murders of Penelope Ross and Stitch Tree. Jojo James had alibis for both murders, and for some reason my word wasn't good enough to put him away for killing Stitch. But what difference would it have made? Jojo would never walk free again. Shady, my man Shady, he also got 5 to 10 for his part in Ida's crimes. If he was a good boy, he'd be out in 2013. My, oh my. A Ducky Ida, it's kind of ironic, laughable even. He was convicted of conspiracy to kidnap Phoebe Marsh and sentenced to 12 years federal. He's in the same prison in Atlanta, 2 cells down from his old buddy Frank Marsh. Phoebe Marsh didn't take the news that Penny was dead very well. Apparently the two were childhood friends, had attended the same schools together. Kate and I accompanied Phoebe to Penny's funeral. She didn't have much to say, didn't know what she was going to do. Then a couple of months later, Kate told me that Phoebe had applied to the police academy and that she, Kate, had sponsored her. 9 months later, Kate and I attended her graduation and induction into the department. Me? Kate and I spent a lot of time together the next 2 months. She working on my office and, well, she managed to rid herself of her new partner, Dick Tracy, and she successfully closed out her first case as lead detective. I did think, for a while, that we might, that maybe. So I spent the next couple of months working my ass off, putting my new company together, trying to get things working smoothly. Tim settled in. Cost me more money than I earned in a year at the PD. Oh, and I did buy him a car. I found him a neat little red MGB GT. I figured it suited his personality. Since then, he's been insufferable, treating me like I'm his dad or something. I'm going to have to fix that somehow, but gently. Jackie continues to brighten my every day, and Ronnie, well, Ronnie is Ronnie. One thing of note did happen during those 2 formative months. I hired Bob Ryan. But that's a whole nother story. So there you have it. That's the story of how I made my transfer from cop to private investigator. Over the next several months, I struggled a bit, trying to get a handle on running my own business and all the responsibility that comes with it. I handled a couple of more cases, made some stupid mistakes, and, well, those are stories for another day.
I hope you enjoyed listening to Genesis. If you did, you might want to take a minute to continue listening to the beginning of Harry Stark, the very first book in the Harry Stark series. Chapter 1 follows. Chapter 1. It was just after midnight. The only sound was the gale force wind howling through the ironwork, blowing in off the river. The snow was almost a blizzard, small flakes flying fast, horizontal. It was cold. I was cold. I pulled up the collar of my overcoat, leaned over the parapet, and stared down into the darkness. The lights from the aquarium and the Market Street Bridge sparkled on the surface of the water. Whitecaps on a river? This is no place to be. So, what the hell am I doing here? A good question, and one for which I had no good answer. I'd spent the hours before midnight at the Sorbonne, a fancy name for a dump of ill repute, one of Chattanooga's sleaziest bars. I frequented it more often than I probably should, mostly to keep an eye on the lowlifes that inhabit the place. That's what I do. Yep, I'd had a couple of drinks. Yes, really, it was only two. And no, I wasn't drunk. If you want to know the truth, I was bored. Bored out of my brains watching the drunken idiots hitting on women they didn't know were hookers. At first, it was kind of funny. Then, just pathetic. Finally, I'd had enough. I left the Sorbonne a little before 12. The company had been bad, the liquor terrible, and the music, well, how do they listen to that stuff? Late as it was, I wasn't ready to go home, so I figured I'd take a walk, wander the streets a little, then grab a cab and go to bed. That was a stupid thing to do. Chattanooga isn't the friendliest town at midnight in winter, but there I was. I ended up on the Walnut Street Bridge, freezing my ass off, staring down into the water, and I was a little nervous. I wasn't worried that I might get mugged or anything. Far from it. I'm a big guy and an ex-cop, and I was carrying a concealed Smith & Wesson M&P9 in a shoulder rig under my left arm. But there was something in the air that night, something other than the driving snow, and I could feel it. It made my skin crawl, something I couldn't put my finger on. I'd walked a few yards north on Broad, turned right on Fifth, then left on Walnut, and from there to the bridge, a pedestrian-only walkway across the Tennessee River to North Shore. I was still on the south side, on the second span, leaning on the parapet, looking west along Riverfront Parkway. I must have been standing there, shivering, for more than 30 minutes when I saw her. Well, I heard her first. She was on Walnut, running toward me, her heels clicking on the sidewalk. I recognized her. I'd seen her earlier in the Sorbonne. She'd been sitting at the bar with two men, two tough-looking creeps, one tall and black with slick-back hair, the other one not so black, better dressed, smaller, and obviously the alpha. They were both wearing those shiny quilted jackets. I'd wondered at the time what the hell she was doing there with them. She was out of their league by a mile. A classy, good-looking woman who looked as if she'd be more at home at the country club than at Benny Hinkle's sleazy dive. She was maybe 26 or 27 years old and wearing one of those little black dress things that cling and stick to every curve. She had red hair. Not that gaudy, fiery orange kids seem to go for these days. A muted amber that was either her own or had to cost more than most people earned in a week. But it was her face that grabbed you. She might have been right out of one of those glossy fashion mags, a face that could only have come from good breeding. Wow, there's an old-fashioned term. And I remember thinking, she's probably the wife or daughter of one of the movers and shakers up on the mountain. Add the pair of 5-inch black stilettos and the white cashmere parka that could only have come from Fifth Avenue or Rodeo Drive, and I knew immediately that she was no ordinary working-class pickup. So, what's she doing here arguing with those two? I remember how I shook my head and stared at her legs. They went all the way up to her ears and then some. I didn't dwell on her for long. I was too wrapped up in my own workaday problems to give a damn. But there was something about her that caught my interest and wouldn't let go. Now, here she was in the wind and snow, running, frightened, looking back over her shoulder as if she were being chased. Then she tripped, stumbled, almost fell. I started toward her, but as soon as she saw me, she stopped. She put her hands to her mouth, looked desperately about her, then turned, ran to the rail, and started to climb. No! I sprinted the few yards that separated us, but I was too late. She was on the rail before I could reach her. She looked wildly around, first along Walnut and then at me, and then she jumped. I dove the last couple of yards, my arms outstretched, and I managed to grab the collar of that fancy parka with both hands. I slammed into the rail. Man, she was heavy. I hung onto the fabric, hauled on it as hard as I could, but it wasn't enough. She simply threw her arms over her head, slipped out of it, and fell. I barely heard the splash over the noise of the wind howling through the ironwork overhead. I leaned over the rail and looked down. Nothing. Just the white caps on the river, some 80 feet below. She wouldn't last more than a few minutes in those icy waters, supposing she'd even survive the fall. I took out my cell and dialed 911. There was nothing else I could do. I told the operator what had happened, gave her my name and location, and settled down on one of the bench seats to wait. The parka folded over my lap. I picked it up. It was heavy. Okay, okay, I'm a nosy son of a bitch, but I'm a private detective and the temptation was just too much. I searched the pockets. I didn't find much. There was a set of keys to a BMW in one, and a pair of white cashmere gloves and an iPhone 6 in the other. I pulled down the zipper at the front, looked at the tag and inside of the collar. Neiman Marcus. In the inside pocket was a leather clutch, pale blue, with a snap closure at the top. It was unusual, obviously expensive, and a little larger than those handy little accessories most trendy young women like to carry. I opened it and rifled through the contents. Jeez, $2,300 in hundreds, and God knows how much in 50s and 20s. I put the money back, fiddled some more, found 3 business cards, also expensive, and a key. An ordinary key, as far as I could tell. The cards read Tabitha Willard. Her address, her occupation. Nada. There was nothing on it other than the name and a phone number. I searched the purse and all of her pockets again, but again found no driver's license, no ID. Keys to a Beamer, but no license. That was strange. By now, I could hear sirens coming, so I returned everything to the purse but one of the cards, which I slipped into my own overcoat pocket, and returned the purse to the inside pocket of the parka. What the hell have you done now, Stark? I might have known. It took only my name and a 911 call to attract the attention of the CPD in general and Sergeant Lonnie Guest in particular. That fat bastard hated my guts and didn't care who knew it. He had since we were at the police academy together. He couldn't stand how tough it had been for him and how easy for me. I always wondered how he made it through at all, much less pass the final exam. Then I found out. The SOB was a cousin to the mayor. Even that didn't help much. As soon as the cousin lost the election, Lonnie lost his support. He made sergeant 8 years ago, just before the mayor left office. It was his honor's last official act. His way of getting back at the city for not supporting him. Lonnie's going nowhere in the department. Has no chance of promotion. The dumbass can't pass the lieutenant's exam. I looked up at him and smiled the smile I knew chapped his jaw. Not a thing, Lonnie. I just made the call. She went over the rail into the water. I managed to save her coat. Here you go. I tossed it to him. He caught it and scowled, first at the coat, and then at me. Your trouble, Stark. Nothing but trouble. You may have the rest of them flim-flam, but not me. We should have locked you away years ago. Tell me what happened. Nah, I'll wait till someone who knows what they're doing gets here. No point in spilling it all twice. You tell me, you arrogant son of a bitch. I'm first officer on the scene. So you are, Lonnie, so you are. Is that soup you have on your shirt? He looked down. I laughed. Gotcha. Screw you, Stark, you piece of shit. I looked at my watch, took out my phone, texted Lieutenant Gazzara, and asked her to come on down. She would not be pleased. Suicide, Lonnie. She ran along Walnut like the devil was after her. Spotted me and hopped over the rail. Gone, Lonnie. End of the river. Suicide. The phone vibrated in my pants pocket. I pulled it, unlocked it, and read the text. Now look, Lonnie. Kate Gazzara will be here in just a few, so why don't you go back to your cruiser, where it's nice and warm, or maybe take a nap, and I'll just hang out on this bench right here until she arrives. One of these days, she ain't going to be around to save your ass, Stark, and I want to be there when that happens. Yeah, well, in the meantime, you probably should make some calls. I get some boats down there, and divers, too. Not that they'll find anything in this mess. I looked up into the swirling snowstorm. It must have been blowing 20 miles an hour, at least. Who the hell you think you are, Stark? I give me orders. You just keep your trap shut and let us do our job, okay? Then he did as he was told. He got on the phone and requested help from the Tennessee Wildlife River Patrol and a dive team. Ah! I grinned and settled down to wait, but not for long. She arrived less than 5 minutes later in an unmarked, and I was right. She didn't look happy. This had better be good, Harry. Bringing me out in this weather? I'd been home less than 10 minutes when you texted. I was on my way to bed. She sat down on the bench beside me. I turned to look at her. She always amazed me. No matter what time of day or night, Kate always looked good. Almost 6 feet tall, slender figure, ripped, I suppose is how you would describe it. She works out a lot. When she's at work, she keeps her long, tawny hair tied back, but it was down just then, cascading around her shoulders, whipped by the wind. She has huge, hazel eyes and a high forehead. She was wearing jeans tucked into high-heel boots that
came almost up to her knees, and a white turtleneck sweater under a short tan leather jacket. Even at 1 o'clock in the morning in the middle of a snowstorm, she looked stunning. So, tell me what happened. And I did. I told her the events of the past 40 minutes, culminating with the girl taking a dive from the bridge. She didn't interrupt. She listened carefully to every word, nodding every now and then she started asking questions. So, Harry, she looked me in the eye, slumming again, huh? Why do you do it? Why do you go to places like the Sorbonne? Just keeping my ear to the ground. It's in places like the Sorbonne where you learn things, not the fancy bars and restaurants. So, what did you find in her pockets? Kate! I tried to sound indignant, as if going through the woman's clothing was something I would never even think of doing, but she knows me better than I know myself. She tilted her head sideways and raised her eyebrows. An unspoken question. Okay, I sighed and shook my head.
Yes, I glanced through her stuff. She rolled her eyes. I hung on to this.
I handed her the card.
There are two more just like it in her purse, wallet, whatever the hell it is.
There's also a wad of cash and a fob for a late model BMW, the keyless type. No driver's license, though. Strange, huh?
She nodded, fingered the card, turned it over, and looked at the back.
Hey, Sergeant Guest!
She had to shout to be heard over the wind.
Bring that coat over here, will you, please?
Please? I'd have told the creep to get his fat ass over here, and quick! But I guess she's more lady than she is cop.
No, that ain't true.
The lady's a lady, but she's all cop.
We both watched as the big sergeant leaned inside his cruiser and retrieved the parka.
Jeez, am I glad I haven't just eaten.
He backed out of the car, then sauntered over. You ever seen a fat guy saunter?
It's hilarious.
The look on his face was a treat to behold, too, when he dropped the coat on her lap. He looked like he'd just bitten into a lemon.
Might be a good idea to search this light-fingered piece of garbage while you're at it, Lieutenant, he said with a smirk. There's a whole lot of cash in the wallet. Some of it might have stuck to Stark here.
He nodded down at me. I grinned back up at him.
That's enough of that talk, Sergeant. How long before wildlife and the divers get here?
They're on the way. Shouldn't be too much longer. I'll go wait in the cruiser if it's okay with you.
Yeah, go on. I'll call if I need you.
She waited until he was back inside his car before she handed me the card.
I didn't give you that. If anyone asks, you stole it, right?
I nodded.
Kate, the girl was frightened out of her mind. She seemed fine when I saw her earlier in the bar with two nasty-looking creeps. What the hell could have scared her like that? And what was she doing with those two? I've seen them around, but I don't know who they are. She's a lovely kid, Kate. I want to know what happened.
She didn't answer. She got to her feet, unfolded the parka, and let out a low whistle.
Whoa, cashmere, Neiman Marcus. This little number must have set her back at least $4,000, or maybe more. What I wouldn't give for one of these.
She tucked the coat under her arm and opened the clutch.
How much money is there here, Harry?
She rifled through the wad of bills.
I'm not sure. 2,300s, along with 950s and 820s. $2,910 in all. That's a lot of cash to be carrying around loose. especially in a place like the Sorbonne. What could she have been thinking? I nodded, but I didn't say anything. The divers were arriving on Riverfront Parkway, and there were blue lights flashing on the river. Tennessee Wildlife was here, too. Okay, Harry, you better take off and go home. Oh, and Harry, I know you're going to be looking into this. You can't help yourself. This time, though, that's probably a good thing, because we can't. It's a suicide, plain and simple. You said so yourself. We'll try to identify her, contact her next of kin, and all that. When we do, I'll call you. But you're right. From what you saw in the bar, there may be something more going on here. If so, we need to know. That's on you, Harry. I'll help if I can, but stay out of trouble and keep that goddamn gun in its holster. One more incident like the last one, and I won't be able to save you. You got that? She was talking about something I'd done a couple of months ago. I had to pull my weapon on a suspect. Turned out the guy was innocent. He didn't press charges, but the police weren't too happy about it. It wasn't the first time they didn't like something I did, though, and it surely wouldn't be the last. Got it. I'll start first thing in the morning. I looked at my watch. Damn, it already is morning. Harry, if you find out anything, anything at all, call me, please. Otherwise, we'll stay in touch by text, right? I agreed. She folded the Neiman Marcus and walked slowly, head down, back to her car. As she passed Guest's patrol unit, she stopped, leaned in the window, and said something I didn't hear. 2 minutes later, she hit the starter, did a 3-point, and then sped off along Walnut. Then turned left on East 4th, going east toward the hospital. Going home, I supposed. I didn't wait until morning. I walked off the bridge onto Walnut, then turned right and found a bench outside the aquarium. I took the card out of my pocket and punched a number into my phone. Yeah? A male voice answered. Tabitha Willard, please. Click. Son of a bitch, he hung up. I tried again, but there was no answer. Okay, so it would have to wait until the city was awake. Bed seemed like a good idea. I checked my watch, 1:15. I called a cab, then hunkered down in a doorway out of the wind and waited. It was no more than a 15-minute ride to my place at that time in the morning. I paid the cabbie, slipped him an extra 10, and wished him good night, what was left of it. I threw my coat down on a chair in the kitchen, poured myself a stiff measure of Lafroig quarter cask scotch, and flung myself down on the sofa in front of the picture window. The wind and snow had slacked off almost to nothing, just a light breeze and a few flurries. A light mist covered the surface of the river, a soft gray blanket that swirled and undulated, turning the mighty Tennessee into a living thing. The view from my window was, as always, spectacular. I lay there, staring out over the water, savoring the 10-year-old malt. My brain was in overtime. The events of the past few hours all came flooding back. Time after time, I saw the horrified look on the girl's face when she spotted me. I kept remembering the way she dropped, slowly turning end over end, splashing into the murky water far below. Was there anything else I could have done to save her? I was sure the question would haunt me for a very long time. There'd be no sleep for me tonight. Christ! What a way to go.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to Genesis, Book 1 in the Harry Stark Genesis series. This book was written by Blair Howard, narrated by Tom Lennon. Copyright 2019, Blair Howard. Production copyright, Blair Howard.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.